Welcome to Barnyard Language, honest talk about running farms and raising families. We are Katie and Arlene, an Iowa sheep farmer and an Ontario dairy farmer, with six kids, two husbands, and a whole lot of chaos between us.
While this is a podcast for farm families, sometimes our content isn't for the whole family. So kick off your boots, reheat your coffee, and join us for some Barnyard Language.
Welcome to another episode of Barnyard Language. So Katie and I are talking eclipses today because as we're recording, it's eclipse day, or at least it is where I am because all the kids got the day off school so that they, if they stare at the sun, then it's our problem and not the teacher. So Katie, is it eclipse day where you are? I'm guessing you're a little further from the path of totality than I am.
We're actually supposed to be like 85% totality or something, but we're also like 100% cloudy. So, who knows? I imagine it'll get darker or something, probably.
Might get dark.
Yes, we got eclipse glasses. No, we probably don't need them. So, there's that.
Did the kids get a day off school, though?
Oh, hell no. Little shits. They got to go to school. Learn stuff. Learn stuff from people they believe in.
Yes.
The girl child was telling me all about how eclipses work because Miss Flaherty told them, her teacher. Nothing that mommy says can be trusted over what Miss Flaherty says, which is a valid and legitimate point. My parenting style is very much making sure that my kids will never be taken in by any sort of scam, by trolling them mercilessly at this age. They don't believe a damn thing I say, and they don't believe much that anybody else says either, which I think will stand them in good stead later, hopefully.
Or they have a complex where they don't trust anyone.
Eh. Oh, well.
They'll figure it out.
Yeah, they'll be fine. They'll be fine.
Yeah. And what's the lamb report?
We are done, except for four yearlings who aren't expected to lamb for another week or two. But other than that, we're done. Just getting ear tags put in everybody and getting them kicked outside. It's a whole lot of cute. It's a whole lot of noise. Lot of noise. And I have been trying to make videos, but there's a lot of lamb play involves a lot of sexual sorts of behaviors, you know, in a show of dominance kind of way. So in the interest of,
you don't think Instagram wants that?
Well, they might. I don't know. I guess I could set up an Only Lambs account if people would.
There you go.
You know, like OnlyFans, but only lambs would just be sheep. It's noisy. It's very noisy. Very bouncy. Other than that, not much. I don't know. How are things at your place, Arlene?
Nothing too exciting. We did get a day off school for everybody. I think in part because we are quite close to the path of totality and the eclipse is happening right around dismissal time. So I imagine that it was probably more of a liability issue. We were supposed to have a day off in April anyway, so they just swapped that teacher's professional development day for today. So the kids are off school. We got a couple pairs of eclipse glasses. It's pretty cloudy here too, so we'll see. Maybe we'll see something. Maybe we won't, but that is a thing where none of us are probably going to be around the next time it happens. So we'll give it a try anyway. And what else do I know? We bought a couple of new heifers, apparently. It is sale season, apparently.
Apparently. I like that. Apparently.
I am not super involved in the selection and decision-making when it comes to buying new genetics because I trust my husband and daughter's opinions, and I don't really have strong opinions on that kind of stuff. So, yes, there's been a couple new purchases have arrived. They may end up as 4-H animals, may not. Most of the time, those decisions are based on genetics that are going to be for longer term than just show season. So if they look good, they might end up being somebody's 4-H animal, but that's not why they're, or that's not their main purpose for being purchased and brought into the herd. The other thing, I mean, I think a lot of us, especially in the dairy sector, are really paying a lot of attention to is all the news around avian influenza moving into dairy animals. So no sign of it in Canada yet, but I know it's in lots of states already at this point. So reading lots of articles and just kind of, you know, seems like every day there's new speculation on what might be happening, how it might be spreading, how it arrived in the first place. So don't really know what it means yet for us, if anything, but keeping an eye on it. I know we got a fact sheet from our federal, like at the Dairy Farmers of Canada the other day, and there was lots of info about, you know, trying to reduce interaction with birds, which is basically impossible. We have the entire field behind our house is filled with Canada geese right now, and they are migratory birds. And we have panels in our barn that open and close with the weather, and birds fly in and back out again. And that's just the way it is in barns. So I don't really know that there's a whole lot that you can do to prevent interactions between cows and birds, but we'll do the best we can, I guess.
So you're saying that you guys don't just call them us geese?
No, they're not. Yeah. We still claim them as ours, I guess. There's way too many.
So for those of us who are not dairy farmers and have not been paying attention, what's the impact on dairy cattle from avian influenza?
So at this point, it's mostly about the fact that it has appeared, and it so far looks like it impacts milk production and mostly in older animals. So I think the first herds that were affected were in Texas, and now it's appeared in a few other states, but they're still not really sure how it transfers. The cows seem to recover fine. It's not something that causes huge health impacts, but it's more, you know, trying to figure out what the issue is and why and how they're getting it.
So should we invite our guest on for this week?
Suppose we ought to.
I think if I'm not wrong, maybe our first Kansas guest. So welcome to the podcast, Carissa. We always start each of our interviews with the very same question. So this is your way to introduce yourself. And we always ask, what are you growing? So that can be kids and crops and livestock and businesses and all kinds of other stuff. So Carissa, what are you growing?
We're growing a lot. We have two kids that one of them is home part-time with us. So she is like also, she's definitely part of the top responsibilities during the day. We also are growing meat for our meat business, so direct-to-consumer meat business. We're growing calves for somebody else. And then we are hopefully growing crops. We're in the process of purchasing land to have our own crops, which will be a new enterprise for us that we've never had before. So we're growing a few things. We have a hands in a few different pots.
Yeah, that is a lot of different things. So I'll start with a few questions. So what ages of kids are we talking about? We like to have an idea.
Yeah, so young. We had them very close together. We have a 2.5-year-old and a 1-year-old. So we had two under two for a little while, and it was a little hectic. I recommend it, but it was a lot.
Katie's are close together like that, too.
Yeah, it took us a while, so it was a real surprise to have two babies in 16 months. We have a friend whose kids are closer, and I think her advice was absolutely right, that it's harder on the parents, but really nice for the kids, because now, you know, they have the same friends, they're at the same age level for things they want to do on a weekend or whatever. They wear the same size clothes, which is awesome, and, you know, and you're done with potty training sooner, unless you have more of them, so.
Unless, I feel like once you're done with diapers, you're just done. So we're in that in-between, like, we're almost there. They are close to sharing clothes, but not quite there yet. But they do like to play together, and it is good for them. And it's harder on you.
Yeah, yeah. But it is nice, you know, people were so like, well, but you have two in diapers. And I'm like, but they're both in diapers. You know, it's when one's potty training and one's in diapers is way more chaos.
Yeah, it's kind of hectic. Yeah. And I feel like that's where we're in. We're in that in-between where we just started potty training the one, and the other one is still in diapers. So we're like in that. I'm hoping they both potty train quickly because one is like picking up on the other. Like she likes playing with the potty. She likes flushing the toilet. I'm like, well, we're getting there. Like we're going to do them both early or both at the same time and just be done.
Yeah. And so far that's lasting for us that, you know, the kindergartner sees his sister reading and he's like, well, if she can read, I can read, and vice versa, that, you know, anytime he starts to pass her in anything, she's like, there is no way, you know. I will figure out how to do this just to keep him from winning. So it gets easier. It'll probably get worse again, but it gets easier.
Yeah, that's good enough. Because I feel like right now is like the youngest wants to play with the big one The big one doesn't, she wants to play on her own terms, but the youngest is like destroying things, you know, the oldest builds. And they're like, I mean, that's good. I feel like that's going to last a little while, but I feel like in a few years, it's going to be a little better.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll get to that stage.
Yeah. Our two are firmly in the either absolute best friends or actively trying to kill each other phase of things. They're 7 and almost 5, or almost 6. So yeah, they're most of the time they're best friends. Yeah.
So back on the egg side, you talked about cows. And so approximately how many are we talking about? Just so people have kind of a sense of scale when we go into our conversation.
Cows we are feeding for other people or cows for our direct-to-consumer meat business?
Kind of both.
Okay. So cows for direct-to-consumer meat business, like we process roughly 6 a month. I think, I don't know how many exactly we have right now in terms of like cows that are on feed, cows that are not on feed. But roughly, our processing schedule is about 6 a month. We kind of had a lull in pork. We still raise pork as well. We kind of had a lull to get fencing here set up. So we had butchered enough pigs before we left to kind of like sell until springtime, until we can get some feeders in and get our sows, you know, restarted back up here. But roughly, we average about 6 a month of pigs and 6 a month of beef. So that kind of keeps us in flux. Cattle on feed, I think like 400 to 500 is what we're feeding for other people. We like to keep it steady. I mean, that's been a nice income. You know, direct-to-consumer meat business is like very fluctuating. So like certain times a year are busier than others. And when we started, we didn't know that. Like we knew that we thought they would be consistent to some capacity and we'd have some, you know, increase during the holidays. We didn't realize it is like literally like a wave where there is highs and there are lows and you kind of have to ride it out. So the custom feeding business has been really helpful to kind of steady our income and give us, you know, consistent, steady cash flow to pay all the bills.
Yeah, that's right. And when you said that you're starting to look at growing crops, I know that you made a move recently, but our listeners wouldn't know about that. So what was the move and what kind of, yeah, how did you end up in Kansas and what did your farming look like there versus where you are now?
So we, in Ohio, we literally just did direct-to-consumer meat business. We didn't do anything with crops. We did hay for our own cattle, but we did not, like, we literally just sold meat. My husband lost his job at the time we were expanding our meat business. I still had a full-time job at the state at the time, and we had a daughter. So we literally just put everything we had into growing the meat business, which was great for that area. We were literally 45 minutes from downtown Columbus, which was really nice because we had the best of both worlds. We had convenience of like shops and stores and like shipping was cheaper and just like so many things that you could get with. We were like a hub for, but we also had like the rural aspect. When Intel came in, it was really like everyone loved the idea of Intel and it was great for some farmers in the area because they just sold out. For the people who actually wanted to keep farming, it became very, very difficult. The price of land went up drastically. So originally when we started the farm, we started with 7 acres and then we rented 7. And then we sold that right before we got married and we bought 54. And then we rented, I don't know, like 200 or 300 acres of hay ground to supply for, you know, all of the animals, the sheep at the time, the cattle, all the things. And it was on a main highway. We noticed it kept just getting busier and busier and busier. And then they put in like $2 million homes on that same road. So then when that sold, like when that became like it was going to start selling, we started asking our landlords like, hey, are you in the position? Do you want to sell? And they're like, well, the price is right. You know, like we know we can't stand in the way of development. Like it is coming whether you like it or not. So we started like really realizing that like, one, we can't afford to buy more acres. Two, one of the farms we decided to rent was like $20,000 just to rent it for hay ground. And that's not, it didn't pencil. It didn't pencil for grass. We could get smaller acres to like move cattle on, but it was like 5 to 7 acres. You can't fit very many cattle on that. So then you were spending all day moving like cattle to one area to the next. We had discussed maybe doing solar panels for the sheep. And then realized like that was years in the making. We weren't going to wait around for that. The sheep market was good, so we sold all of our sheep at that time because it was just we were good. We were near one of the highest. You know, they have a huge basically hub for sheep, the sheep sales. So like the sheep market's really, really good there. So we decided to sell them all. And then we started realizing like, hey, if we want to expand cattle, we don't have an area to do it. Chickens were okay, but in our area, it was just becoming where like it was our highest input at the time. And we did. We raised chicken, pork, beef, and lamb. And then we slowly started realizing like, hey, we need to like narrow this down because it's not penciling out. So sheep, you know, were very labor intensive. They kept getting out. The market was good to just sell live animals. So we decided to sell them off. Beef, not many people were doing in our area. So we're like, hey, this is a good market. Pork, we still kept. Chickens, they took so much input and so much like high cost and a lot of labor that the profits really weren't there, especially if you had like a really rainy year or like Ohio has very fluctuating temperatures. So like you could go from like dry as a bone to like, I don't know, like 4 to 5 inches of rain, like within a few hours. Like when it downpours, like it wouldn't really absorb in the soil. So we had a lot of flooding and it just wasn't working in that region. And we raised a lot of chickens. Like we raised 15,000 chickens a year. And we were realizing like we're putting all this money into chickens. Our feed bill is like over $100,000 and we're not seeing but pennies coming from this. So is it really worth it? So all that came into play, having a kid, increasing prices in land. And a friend of my husband's actually lives in Kansas where we live now. They never went to college together, but they shot competitive shooting in college. So they always would meet up at different regions. And they became best friends. And he always joked with my husband that if he wanted to, like, they would always have a place for him here. So, like, he approached him and said, hey, you know, we're looking to move. We need more acres. It's not working here. And he said, well, if you want to come work for us in exchange for equipment and you can buy your own, you know, buy your own crop ground, there'll be a place for you. You can use all of our equipment. You can use our labor. However, you have to buy your own, you know, your own ground to farm. And we're like, well, we've never done it before, but my husband likes riding in a tractor. He's learned a lot since we've been here. So we decided that would be our chance to get more acres and have like an actual longevity for our family, for a farm. If we would have stayed, I think, in that area, we not only wouldn't have had, we would have basically become, you know, a farm stand or we weren't raising our own stuff. And I was okay with that. My husband was not. Like his heart was in the actual, you know, deep poop, touching animals, like saving lives, like actually doing, like growing the animal and the crop. So he would not have been as happy. So we decided to move. We moved in September and it was we put everything up for auction. Some things didn't sell for what they were, like what they wanted for, like the timing really matters. And we hit the time where equipment started going down, land values started going up. Interest rates were rising. It wasn't like the perfect scenario, but we did okay. We pretty much sold everything but our freezer. Our freezer we brought here and our smoker, and then we packed up all of our belongings and we headed west. It was a rough transition because we lost pretty much everything we owned. They stole everything we owned in our U-Haul. So then we're moving to this new house. We didn't know anybody. All of our stuff was gone. And we had to depend on people that we've never met before to help us out because we didn't have insurance on any of our personal belongings. The insurance we had on all of our business stuff was like, they're like, oh, well, it's a depreciation asset. So like, we're going to give you like, I don't know, I think it was like $3,000 for like the $30,000 in receipts I submitted, which included like my computer, printer, all the things. And I'm like, what was the point of insurance? I paid more than $3,000 for my insurance. So it was definitely a learning curve. We didn't have access to get a computer here. So we had to drive like 3.5 hours to Denver to go find a computer. Social Security is like a few hours away. So we had to go get that done. It definitely was a learning curve knowing that we had close proximity to like an Apple store or like a Best Buy and Social Security. And I don't know, all the things where I was like, now it's like we live pretty far out. So. It definitely was a learning curve and like replacing all those things. I definitely don't regret it. I feel like we really have enjoyed our time here so far. We haven't been here that long, but in a way it feels like we've been here forever because people have been so welcoming. And we decided once we got out here, our land didn't sell like as quick as we had hoped. We were told it would be about a year, but we didn't know for sure with the way things were going. In Columbus. So we decided to wait. And because of that, because of our, you know, rocky transition out here, you know, meat sales were lagging because I couldn't get a rep to call me back because I had to get a new sales rep out here. We didn't have a computer. I lost a lot of my information. So our freezer got delayed. Meat got delayed. Like, it was just one thing after the other. So meat sales were kind of like, they weren't, before they were our main income, when we got out here, they were probably a quarter. So we had to figure out a way to supplement our income. We had some savings, but, you know, you don't want to live on that. So we decided to rent the area, like the grow area where we like grow calves for somebody else. We knew we wanted to do that, but we didn't know how soon we'd be able to do it. And then we had a few people approach us like, hey, we actually need someone to grow calves for us. And we're like, OK, so we started, you know, started with a few. And then quickly, a lot of people said, hey, we have more, you're, you know, you're doing a great job. So that has become like a good portion of our income right now, which has been really, really nice because it takes kind of the pressure off the meat business in some way until we can get the crop ground. And our land in Ohio just sold like a week or two ago. We just finally closed on it. So we are finally in a position where we can take all that money and buy land. So we're really excited and nervous because it's a different avenue. And who knows in today's world and economy and weather and all the things, like farming is just like putting faith in Mother Nature. It's very scary.
And you've gone through a ton of change in a short amount of time too. So this is just, yeah, one more round of change, more things to learn.
Yeah, I don't recommend it. But we tend to go like full in to the water when we do something. Like a lot of people in ag, you just like jump right in. It is scary, but it all works out eventually. It's just scary in the short term.
Podcasts are free to listen to, but they aren't free to create. Katie and I would appreciate your support as we work to build the Barnyard Language community.
Patreon is an easy way for you to make a contribution that goes directly to making the show. As a member of our Patreon community, you get to watch the video version of our weekly updates, complete with questionable hairstyles and clutter. With three levels of support, you can choose a tier that works for you.
Keep the podcast going by becoming a patron today at patreon.com/barnyardlanguage.
So, Chris, as someone whose hometown is getting... I grew up in central Iowa, and the urbanization is a real issue. And, you know, I have some friends who are vegetable farmers where it's a little less, like, the land price thing is its own situation. But you don't have cows, like, running through the neighbor's freshly sodded yard or pooping or making noise in the middle of the night or, you know, weaning calves or whatever. But I hadn't, you know, I was going to ask you about the availability of infrastructure that I think people don't think about too, that like when urbanization starts, the farm store closes, you know, there's not an implement dealer in the middle of the city. There's not, you know, you deal with those issues, but I hadn't really considered that then when you move further out, like I'm 2 hours from a Target and I think 3.5 hours from an Apple store, but I'm used to it because that's just how it is out here. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about how much harder the human infrastructure is when you go from a place that's getting really urban to, sounds like Western Kansas or Central Kansas, if you went to Denver.
What, very, very west. Yep. Northwest.
Yeah. So are there any humans in your area? I mean, I'm from Iowa. Like, we have to make fun of Kansas. I think there's a law. Like, you're above Oklahoma, but not.
It is like 12, I think. I asked my husband, I think the population is 1,200. They haven't posted on a sign, and they're very...
For what area? For like half of Western Kansas, or?
I think just for my county, but I'm not 100% sure. The class, they always measure by class size, they told me. So like a graduating class is like roughly like 50 people. And I thought, like, I came from like a rural town in Ohio, and I thought it was rural, and it was not. Compared to Kansas, it's like my graduating class was, I think, like 200, and I thought that was small. My husband's graduating class was like, I don't know, over 1,000, almost 2,000. So I feel like we both went from like thinking we know small towns to like t- to not. So it definitely was a shock.
I know, too, I have friends who live in, like, eastern Montana, which is just its whole own thing, you know, where you're, like, 2 hours from Walmart. Like, most places, there's a Walmart within half an hour easily. And, you know, yeah, I graduated in a school of 400 in my class. You know, my kids are in a school where there's going to be 60, 70 in their class. But I have friends whose kids are in classes of, like, five, you know, like, kids who are still going to one-room schoolhouses. And it is, like, it's such a thing because, you know, I work for Microsoft. My coworkers all live in big cities. And they're like, the idea that we can't get food delivered is just, like, mind-blowing. And then you're like, but I know people whose kids still go to one-room schoolhouses, like, in the U.S. right now. And it's not, like, a cult or anything. Like, it's just, you know, rural. And I just...
It's a shock. It's a mindset change of, like, knowing that, like before we had access to several different grocery stores within 20 minutes, and now it's, like, we have one grocery store in town. If we want to go to Walmart, I think it's, like, 36, 40 minutes one way, and it's a smaller, you know, a smaller Walmart. And you work with your local groceries to get things in that you want. But it definitely was a shock, you know? Like, we were also lucky. We had a cat dealer, like, 40 minutes away. I think all of our hay equipment was like an hour-ish for a mechanic.
I'm just going to clarify for folks who don't have bigger equipment that you mean Caterpillar and not like, I was just for a moment picturing an actual cat dealer. Like, we got your Siamese, we got your tabbies, you know, like.
I'm sure there were those too, but no, yeah, Caterpillar. Like, because of all the construction we were lucky to have, like, actual, like, we used Caterpillar dealer a lot for like different parts for our skid loader, and then tractor, there was still a few small mechanics around who helped us work on those and get parts in, but not the, like, the dealerships out here. And parts came pretty quickly because, you know, you were near, like, the big airport where they would ship that kind of stuff in. But there actually was a limit because of all the construction with Intel. There was actually limited how much concrete you could get in, because all the concrete in the area went to Intel, and a lot of the lumber then went to Intel. So, like, a lot of homeowners were limited on what they could get. And there was still, like, more shortages than probably other places because Intel got first dibs on a lot of the manufacturing products that for their business.
I know, too, I don't know how the pandemic affected your meat sales and your general availability of things, but, like, my husband worked for one of our local implement dealers for more than 20 years. And I know folks were so surprised that implement dealers were considered essential workers. But, like, you know, cows still have to be milked. Food still has to be grown. Tractors still have to get fixed.
We noticed, like, meat sales went up. People's personalities were a little crazy. Like, people were more demanding and kind of rude about it. So, like, if you had, you know, a day where something got out or you were late, people were like, well, I need it right this second. It's like, I'm coming, you know, things. People were definitely a little bit more irritable with it. I would say they were a little bit more, I would say, optimistic with different cuts and weren't as picky. So if you were out of something, they were willing to kind of adjust, which that has changed now that availability is here. It was tough, like, going to our butcher shop because, you know, gas station was going to be closed, and, like, where we have kids, we would always go in the evening together. So that way one of us would drive down, the other would drive back, and we would just take our kids with us. But when, like, gas stations are closed, you got to make sure you have fuel beforehand because they're not open at night anymore. So that definitely was tough, like, kind of navigating that and dinner and packing PB&Js because you couldn't get pizza from a gas station because the inside was closed. So, yeah, that definitely, the pandemic, I would say, hurt us with accessibility to a lot of different things. You know, feed could get delayed if someone got sick. Feed prices obviously went up, and different parts took a little longer. Like, fuel filters were hard for us. Like, we couldn't get fuel filters in for the pickup truck. So we had to adjust. So different things like that.
How were you in terms of processing animals? Or did you have enough spots pre-booked that you were okay? Or was that a factor? Yeah.
Yeah, we were really lucky in the fact that, like, we worked with two smaller, like, plants. In Ohio, like, that's the difference between Ohio and Kansas, is that Ohio had a lot more, like, a lot of people complained about Ohio's processing plants. But, like, the reality is, like, we had way more than anybody else. So it's like don't complain when you don't know the other side of the coin. Like, we were very, very fortunate. We had a lot of processing plants that, you know, that were smaller, you know, USDA or even state inspected plants. And we worked with a USDA plant at the time where we had booked all of our animals a few years in advance. And when you butcher more animals, and like, they liked us more because, like, one, we had more than one animal and our cut sheet is the same every time. Whereas someone who's like selling halves, wholes, and quarters, like, their cut sheet is different every single time based on the customer that comes in. So like, they would rather work with us than someone else because they know it's the same thing every time and they can train their staff. So it's just easier for them. So we were very fortunate enough that we had all of our butcher dates in advance. So that was very, very helpful. But not everybody was like that because they would just, most people who would do halves and quarters, they would like, oh, hey, mine's ready. Can I need an appointment next week? And they'd be like, okay, that's fine. Like, we have some openings or we'll look at something around. Whereas, you know, during COVID, that wasn't the case. There was no openings because everybody wanted to meet.
I was going to say, we were on the other side of that. So we were selling at farmer's market and we were selling a lot by the pound, but also quarters and halves. And, you know, processing two animals every 3 or 4 months, maybe, or three animals, you know, so a lot less than you guys were doing. And went from being able to get a locker date within 6 weeks at the very outside to, I think they were up to 2.5 years at one point, because it has to be state inspected to sell by the cut, you know, and we're right near the state border. So if you want to be able to sell anything over the line, it has to be federally inspected. So that's two lockers within 3 hours of here. And yeah, I mean, I can't book dates for animals that aren't born yet. You know, that was the end of our direct sales for us, was just couldn't do it, you know, and it's gotten better again, but.
Are you still selling at farmers markets too?
No, childcare mostly. I think we were probably on the way out just with the childcare, because spending that much money to not make much money and then never seeing my kids was kind of like, well, that's great. We still do some like halves and wholes, you know, for folks, but mostly they go to the sale barn, you know. Someday that might change again, but not right now.
I feel like that was the toughest part for us too. Like, that was another considering factor for our move, is that we shipped, but then we did a lot of local deliveries and we did farmers markets. So we did one to two weekday markets, and then I delivered several times a week. And then we also did farmers markets on Saturday. And originally we started doing like two farmers markets on Saturday, and then labor was an issue in childcare. So like, to get someone to help babysit, to get someone to help pack freezers, to get someone to actually help me at farmers market where we needed two people, it was just like, people would flake, they wouldn't show up, like childcare would be sick, or like, you know, just all the things that you add into an already packed morning of like getting your kid ready, making sure they have snacks, they have milk, like all the things that they would want was tough. And it was expensive, like, because once you figure in like your time to get your kid there and then pick them up, and then it's usually like 2 hours before farmer's market, 2 hours after farmer's market, and then people are like, well, you have to pick them up by this time, and it's like, well, by the time I get packed up, it's, you know, it's so hard. And like, that was a factor where we ended up downsizing farmers markets because of like farmers market labor, which people don't really think about. But a lot of businesses, like, they couldn't sign up for a market because they didn't have childcare or they didn't have staffing. And then we added in the childcare at farmers market. And like, we love bringing our kids to farmers market because it was easier on us, and cheaper in some ways. But then it was also difficult of like, then I'm distracted by holding a baby, or it's too hot, or it's rainy, or it's too cold. We were lucky that we got a sitter our last year and a half, where she came to one of our Saturday market, and she would take our toddler at the time, and she would take her to her house. They would go to the park, they would go do something fun, and then she would bring her back at the end of farmer's market. And she was a teacher, so she had summers off, and she didn't have kids of her own, so it was easier for her to manage. And oftentimes we'd either trade for meat or we would give her cash and we'd just do a flat rate for farmer's market. And it worked out. But like, if we had a bad farmer's market day, it was like, was it really worth it?
Yeah, I know. We had, you know, when it was one baby, it was kind of like, oh, how cute, you know, and you feel a little like you're like selling your child to be like, look how cute the baby is, give me money. But you do what you do. But yeah, we had one day once there was a second baby and I'm paying a sitter and I'm paying a market stall. And we were doing 2 weekday markets and then a big weekend market. And, you know, paying the sitter, paying the stall fee, driving down there, the whole crap and crap and crap. And I made $6. And I was just like, because, you know, if it rains, you still have all the same expenses, but you don't have any income. And I was just like, I can't do this. Like, this is not working out.
So I know it's still early days in terms of you having moved to a new place, but now you've already talked about there's a lot less people and the farmers markets things are out. So what is that? How does that change your marketing and the way that you sell your product now that you're in a place that's more remote and you don't have those same personal relationships with people? What does that look like once you move more to a shipping model? How does that work?
Yeah. So like for us, definitely has changed because people bought from us at Farmers Markets because they knew our family. Like they knew when our kid's birthday was, if they had a bad week. Like I felt like we really knew all of our customers, which was really important to me because I felt like I had a direct connection to them. So now we have switched to do to doing like we still do our social media, but now I feel like I'm investing more time into like longer term content in terms of blogging. We're working on a YouTube channel so that way we feel like we can really relate to our customers and they can have a deeper relationship. Because now most of our business is shipping. We're switching to like we're also like, you know, diversifying, trying to work with some businesses on like corporate orders and kind of like steady sources of income where we know it's seasonal, but we know it's guaranteed each year. So we're kind of transitioning and kind of diversifying that as well, because it is harder when you're trying to get to somebody. Like now it's people still have a connection with us, but it's also like our product has to speak, you know, volumes, and it has to be something that they genuinely do want for them to continue a relationship with us.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. When you moved, did you bring livestock with you or were you starting over in terms of your actual stock?
Yeah. So cattle, we did. Cattle came out on pods. I think there were two pods that came out with us. Nothing else did. Like we took, we stopped the chickens. Didn't have any of those. Obviously wouldn't bring those because those are short term. The pigs, we actually, our butcher took like two processing slots of pigs and cattle and then kept them at his farm for us. We had like a good relationship with him. So then he finished them for us and then butchered them. And then they came out like freight semi, like a freezer cold storage with the rest of our meat. So that was also really nice. The fact that he was willing to do that. So that still gave us, you know, some extra meat, but we couldn't justify the shipping cost to move all of our stuff. Was just like we didn't have the money to do it, so we had to like use our livestock trailer for some of our like, you know, garden stuff, farm stuff, that type of thing, like tools and that kind of thing to ship out. So we didn't have room for the livestock. So I'm very sad we had to sell my sows because I'd had them since we started and they were so sweet and good with our kids. But those we had to start over. The cattle did come though.
So I don't know that we actually got to this question yet, but what is your background in agriculture? Are you and your husband first generation or are you multi-generation? Yeah. So how did you get into this industry?
So my husband, my parents had like some acres. They had a few cows. My dad never really, like they were just something like yard ornaments. Like he never really had like the knowledge. I never really grew up in ag, like besides the few times a year that I would have to go out and help my parents like break ice, you know, or something like that. Like I did not have any experience in ag. I didn't want anything to do with it. I dabbled in like some show cattle because like I thought it would be something fun to do. And I enjoyed like the boyfriend I had at the time, but like I did not like agriculture. I did not want to live on a farm. I did not want to live. I moved from my small town. I moved to like Central Ohio, Columbus. I wanted to be in politics. I wanted to live in a subdivision. Like I wanted complete opposite of what I have now. And then I started getting farther in my career and I realized that like I didn't have anybody to share it with. So then I got a dog and I was like really happy with my dog and we became best friends and I took my dog everywhere. And then I met my husband and he actually grew up a little bit in Missouri. His dad traveled a lot for work. So like different times would change. So his dad was a veterinarian, but did small animals. So like he went from Cincinnati to like Missouri to the university, I think. And then he lived in two different towns in Pittsburgh area. So like he did not he loved agriculture. His parents, not so much. They still prefer the city. They hate the smell of castles. They don't understand the poop. So he went from he had more of a culture shock than I did in terms of like not even being rural and then living in a subdivision, you know, like neighborhood, library time, all those things to moving. He actually bought the farm originally as like a hobby. He loved like wanting to grow his own food, dug deeper into like the health benefits and stuff like that. And then we met and I was like, well, this poor guy, like he's doing all this work by himself, like he needs help. And then I fell in love with it all over again, realizing that, you know, I didn't really like my office job. I didn't like spending all my day inside under fluorescent lights. Like I really enjoyed like getting my hands into the dirt and like seeing the fruit of my labor, which I think I didn't have growing up because my parents didn't do like the full cycle. It was more of like, it's there if we have it. Like it wasn't, I never got to reap the reward. So like when I met my husband, I got to see like, oh man, here's the meat that came from the animals that we had. You know, here's the connection to the consumer. Here's the impact we're having on our own family. And I definitely fell in love, not only with him, but with the farming. So I don't think I could go back now.
It sounds like you guys ramped up pretty fast though, because I mean, our listeners can't see you, but like, you're not that old. And you talked about, you know, going from working in an office to raising thousands of chickens and now doing consumer beef. So clearly you're somebody who jumps all in.
Arlene, this might be the most serious chicken math we've ever had, because I don't know that we've talked to anyone else who presumably in less than a decade went from zero to, did you say 15,000 birds a year? Yeah. No, this has everybody else beat, I think. I don't think we've ever gotten somebody. I love it.
Yeah. So when I remember sitting at the old farmhouse dining room table, and we were contemplating, like we had started farmers markets the year we had met. And so we kind of like, it was nice because like, even though he had started like the hobbyish farm before, and then when we met, he was like, I signed up for this farmer's market for the first time. And I was like, okay, well I'm in. So like, we kind of started the whole farmer's market and real, I would say the real portion of our business, like early on together. So we both were invested in the people and then the commitment. And we had started with 6,000 chickens, I think that year. And I don't know, like maybe 100 or so sheep. And then we added pigs and then we didn't do very many. And then we realized, well, hey, nobody's doing pigs in the area. Let's just keep ramping it up. And then when we added up the math, we're like, if the number of people who asked us for chicken, you know, there are this many chicken breasts or this many whole chickens, like we really need to like double our sales if we really want to grow. And so at the time we were selling our old farm, so we had our infrastructure there. The new farm didn't have anything. I mean, it was just bare dirt. We had no water, no electric, no fencing, nothing. So we basically, once we sold the old farm, my husband, our plan was to put everything we had into the business. And then my husband would quit his job the following year. And then he lost his job. And we're like, well, we lost that income. Like, now what are we going to do? So our plan was to build a house and everything there. So we didn't end up doing that. We ended up just living with friends, living on the farm in a camper. And then found out we were having a baby. I'm like, well, we can't do this anymore. So then we ended up renting a place. But yeah, it definitely was something where like we calculated it out how much we would sell. Like granted, I wish we would have done looking back now, we should have done a little bit more of gradual like incline, because once you add in the fact like we changed our chicken tractor style to like a more commercialized like greenhouse style where we could pull with equipment. From like the polyphase, the Joel Salatin style chicken tractor, like more hands on, and the automatic waters made a difference. But I wish we would have slowly made changes like automatic waters and easier feeders that held throughout the day, I think our lives would have been easier and we wouldn't have as much upfront expense, because like people don't realize like you're doubling. You think you're gonna sell it quick, but the reality is like, you need a lot of money up front before you reap the return of selling the product. And you have to have freezer space. You have to have more feed. You have to have more feeders, more water, more labor. You have to have your processing bill is bigger. We had to have more chicken crates. We had to have a different, we could no longer take them on our flatbed truck. We had to get like a gooseneck trailer, all the things that you don't realize that go into it, that we learned after we decided to commit to that many more birds.
So I have to know, your very first chicken purchase, as someone who got started in sheep because they were selling out from a flock where a guy started, first group of sheep, 300 ewes, and then realized he didn't like sheep, which feels like, that feels like a lot of sheep to buy before you realize that you don't like sheep, worked out really well for us. How many chickens were in that first order? Were there like 500 chickens in that first order? Or did you start with like 10 and then?
No, I think, you mean like the very first time we started?
Yeah, yeah. Like the very first.
Yeah, I think he did a few hundred when he first, because he had a few chickens before I came around. I think he did a few hundred, and then he did 1,200, and I think then he moved to 3,000 the following year, and then after that we moved to 6,000. So he jumped from, I think, throughout 3,000 in a year to, I think, 6,000. But each flock, I think, I'm trying to remember. I know each pen had, like, I want to say 12 chickens in them. But when we were doing the 15,000, I think each batch had 1,000, if I'm right. I think we had 500 per chicken tractor.
Arlene, I want to get Carissa's husband on here sometime because I have some questions.
He would love that. He would love that.
This is hardcore. I dig it. So how safe do you feel from urban sprawl in Western Kansas?
Very, very safe. That's why when we were discussing the places we wanted to move, the farthest place away from urban sprawl was like, urban sprawl isn't touching us. I mean, people are very like, it's interesting because people in Columbus, like, they say they wanted local, but oftentimes wouldn't make the sacrifice for local, whereas, and to support local businesses, whereas here, people literally make an effort to keep their money local. Like, if you're buying a TV, you're not going to Best Buy or ordering online. You're going to the little shop in town to buy your TV, even if they have to order it in. And you're okay with paying a few hundred dollars more if it means supporting someone local. You know, your grocery store, it may cost a little bit more in town, but you know, you're willing, you may not do all your grocery shopping there, but you're wanting to support your local grocery store because you know what it means for your community. If like you're in a pickle and you really need something, like having access to something in town is really crucial. And people here, like, they are very intentional of who they sell land to. So like breaking into that, like, they don't want to sell to outsiders. They want to sell to someone local. And that has been huge for us too, of like navigating the waters of like, we are the new people, like, we're not, you know, we don't want to sell it, we want to stay here, we want to raise our family here, it breaking into that water. But here I feel like there is, I don't foresee, like, we, when we drive to Denver, like, I've noticed like a lot of ranches out that way selling, and I just think that here, I mean, we still are very far from like a big hospital, you're really far from like big stores. I don't foresee very many people wanting to move out here for that reason. I mean, it takes the right person to want to separate themselves away from, you know, the big cities.
So I checked out your website. It's beautiful. Do you do all the content creation yourself, all the photographs and everything?
Yeah. So we hired, a lot of our photo, like some of our professional photos and video came from a friend who we exchanged meat for, which was really nice. Like, he does it for a living, but he changed me, which was good. And a lot of our photos came from like bartering and trading for that. But then some of them we did for ourselves, or the meat photos, we took some ourselves. Some came from a friend of ours who actually is a customer. She's in school to be a nurse practitioner and she likes free meat. So she does it as a hobby on the side. So she photographs a lot of our meat for us. She is amazing. But I am worried what happens when she decides to stop the hobby and focus on her career, because I don't know who we would find to do photos, because it's taken a long time to like work with her for meat photography, of like what we like, the angles and that type of thing. And there's still a lot we want to replace. But she has done a great job in finding the look that we want, and the price point we can afford, because meat photography is very expensive.
Food photography is so hard. You think, you know, you can just take a picture of things, right? But food in particular, take a picture of your steak and it does not look that good.
Yeah, especially raw meat. It takes a talent to make, and I mean, I say this as a beef producer, it takes a talent to make a raw steak really look appetizing. You know, I mean, it's it's a slab of raw meat. It's, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't look good. But yeah, but I think, I mean, you figure like most people who do it professionally, like their products, even like cereal, is not even the real product. Half the time it's like some like fake putty or something they put in there with glue to make it look perfect. And it's like, we don't do that, obviously. So we're like, how do you make something that is like your real product that looks exactly like the way you have it actually look like something someone wants to buy, like in the grocery store? And it's hard. I am not good at it. And one day maybe, but for now, no.
So I added a question here to poor Arlene with her trying to make things organized. One of the biggest issues I found with doing direct marketing is I like talking to customers. I like doing the website. I like that stuff. But ultimately, I farm because I want to like go outside and play with cows. I don't really want to be writing web copy. How do you have that occasional desire to just tell people to buy some shit and go away so that you can just go do the stuff you need to do? Because it's so like, let me put on my customer service face and answer your stupid questions. And we're not going to let any of your customers listen to this. We'll screen people before they're allowed to hear it. But
yeah. For me, I think like sitting and like doing random stories inside and like things that I know that I have to spend time editing or like writing blogs up for, like just spending all this time on a computer is something like I didn't want when that's not why I fell in love with our business, right? I enjoyed actually like working with my husband. And I think so I have a multi answer to that. I think that's been a transition too for us moving to Kansas, is that I was doing a lot of the customer service and deliveries and hands-on of actually like interacting with people, which I enjoyed parts of that. And I still get that some here, but more on a computer side. So that's been a transition for me to like still finding love in what I do, because now I'm like working through a computer and not a personal face. And I'm less hands-on now because we have a second child and, you know, I can't take our I guess now year old. It's hard for to take her out and work cattle. So it's definitely been a balance, because I feel like when I fell in love with direct to consumer, it was seeing the positive side of that, like people like saying, hey, I love your meat. I love cooking with it. I love knowing your family. And I love seeing you work with your animals, where now it's like, well, you know, it just snowed. It's like 20 degrees outside. I can't really take my infant outside like all day to work cows with my husband. And it's been hard because I'm similar to you, where I really enjoyed working with him. Like I enjoyed running the cattle. I enjoyed feeding all the animals, fixing things. I enjoyed the roller coaster of something broke and we have to learn how to fix it quickly to get things back up. That stress, I miss it. So there are days when I feel like I actually get to like do those things where my heart is happy. So I try and figure out a way to still incorporate it in there, because dealing with customer service and people complaining about something that's like really irrelevant, that doesn't, like they don't even know what they're talking about, is very, very frustrating. Like we had one customer in Florida who was like, this looks, we had to use a different type of dry ice, and it was like the outside was icy, but all you had to do was wipe it off and you could see the meat inside was fine. She was like, it's freezer burnt. Like she's like, send me this hateful email. And then so I call her, I'm like, hey, can we talk through this? Can you send me pictures so I know like what happened? Because I know when I packed it, it wasn't freezer burnt. Like, what is going on? And then she like wiped it off and she was like, my husband came home and he wiped it off and it's actually fine. It was just the dry ice on the outside. I'm like, why would you send her a hateful email? Like preemptively just to talk somebody, like I'm not some corporation that waits out, like this wait on me all day, and it like really broke my heart, and I like didn't want that, you know. Like that part's hard, because I feel like my husband gets like the fun part of it, of like the animals, and I get the like people complaining because something didn't look right and then they just didn't ask and it was all fine. So yeah, that part's tough.
One, two, I think you have to get in that right headspace to do that sort of like sales content, because people think they want authenticity, but they want like 10% authentic. Like they maybe want to hear if it's muddy, but they don't want to hear about prolapsed sheep. You know, they don't like, they want a tiny bit of authenticity to make it not corporate, but they don't want any of the reality.
People want the corporate look and convenience with the idea that they know the farmer. And that part is hard for me too, because I feel like I am not a salesperson. So the marketing side, like I want to share like the real, the raw, like what's actually happening. And I have found like people think they want that, but they really don't. Like they want the pretty image, the commercialized, like the farms that people really love supporting, I have found, are the commercialized farm with the endless bank account that looks pretty, that they're not actually sharing the real, the raw, you know, in the in-between. So that part has been hard because I take everything personally and I don't treat it like, I treat it as like a passion, probably more than a business in terms of that like emotional side. So that part for me is very, very hard of like the mindset of knowing like I dwell on what someone says or like a negative comment. Like I don't process that as well as I probably should. I've gotten better, but it is hard. It is hard when people are like just so ruthless and just not very kind.
And figuring out that balance too of this is our business and we want to share it with you and we want you to love it because we love it. And assuming that people, if they're supporting a small family farm, that they want to see what you're doing, but then also realizing, maybe on the worst weather days, they don't actually want to see what it actually looks like or the reality of the mud situation out there or whatever it is, right? You know, like there are lots of days where it looks beautiful and sunny and you've got baby calves frolicking in green grass, but there are also days where there's not a lot of frolicking going on and your feet are stuck in that mud. So yeah, it's hard to do both and present people with the family and the small farm, the local, the thing that people say they want, but also, like you said, have that the corporate and, you know, the quick delivery time and everything look perfect when it comes out of the package too, and not have to you know, take a little bit of ice off the wrapping. That would be terrible. Yeah,
I know too, Arlene. You know, we installed cameras in our sheep barn for the first time this year, which came with a lot of, well, when are you going to set up a lamb camera so we can just watch them 24 hours a day? And I'm like, well, A, our internet will not support that. And B, like, I've watched other people's lamb cameras and they're real cute, but they're real heavily managed. And, you know, like yesterday, our camera would have shown me like literally pretty much up to my elbow pulling lambs. Like, nobody wants to see that. And as much as I overshare anyway, nobody wants to listen to what I had to say about being elbow deep inside of a sheep. And, you know, like, yeah, people think they want that connection, but we're protecting them for their own good about how some of these things are.
Well, I feel like it's something that you have to process too in the moment. And like you're emotionally processing the loss of an animal or like a tough situation where it's like, you're not ready to share that either. And you know how hard it is on you that you don't want to, you kind of are protecting your customer in that way.
So one of the things that we connected on online that we want to talk about today, hello, little one, was talking about childcare and rural childcare in particular. So since we've been doing a lot of comparing, what was your childcare situation like when you were in Ohio and what does it look like now?
So Ohio childcare was an option. I think in cities, our biggest, like cities like Columbus, like our biggest, you could always have childcare. It would determine how much you're able to pay. There's always access. It may not be the access you want, but there's at least access to childcare. It may not be what you want because it's not like they don't have the same characteristics you would, or the characteristics you would want your childcare facility, or even a babysitter, but there was still at least options there, but you may have to pay more. Rural Kansas, I feel like there is just not access. Like the process is differently. It's not a waiting list. Like we had to interview the childcare provider that we had. We have our other daughter in is it started off like part time, and then she was able to, once she like got to know our daughter and it started becoming, you know, a good fit for her facility, like we were able to apply for full time. But like it was like an interview process based upon like how well we fit with her facility, not like where we were at in number. Whereas Columbus, you're just a number, like the next kid on the list, you write your check. They don't really care. Here, they genuinely care about people, how well you work with them. So that was definitely different. And then like even if we drove an hour away, like we were still on a waiting list for childcare. So that was also tough. Whereas before, like, we applied, you know, if we called in advance, we would move up. Here, it's just everybody wants childcare and there's just not enough facilities.
There does still seem to be a myth, and assuming that you did not pack some grandparents into one of those pods or into the stock trailer or whatever. Hopefully not into the U-Haul that got stolen, because that would have really been awkward. Somebody opens it and there's just in-laws in there. Just full of in-laws. There's this real feeling that, you know, like a... I'm going to assume that this applies to farm dads as well, but that a real family farm and a whole family should be home at all times. No one should ever actually leave the property. And that if you're not like, and God bless the families who can do it, but that if your kids are not homeschooling and like within arm's reach of you at all times until they turn at least 19, 20, I don't know, that you're doing it wrong. How has that impacted you? Because I know, especially when you're self-employed or you work from home, there's this, well, you're in the house anyway. Like, why can't you do your whole job with your child attached to you? Which, you know, like we've talked about before, you wouldn't expect your plumber to bring their child with them, or, you know, a lawyer or something. I would be pretty concerned if my lawyer showed up with their kid, you know, on any regular basis anyway.
Yeah, I think, and that was when we moved out here, one of the questions someone asked me is like, why do you need childcare? They didn't mean it in a mean way. They were just being like, they were like, I don't understand. Like, what do? That you actually, you know, you can't watch your kids. And like, they thought the hours that I put into our business were like a few hours here and there that I could do during nap time. And I'm like, that's not how our business works. Like, there are days when I'm like literally in our freezer all day or in my shop that's like, you know, not fully heated or not fully AC, that like I can't work with my kids all day, or I don't want to let them spend an entire day in a car seat because we have to go get dry ice. Like, that has been hard of like changing that mindset, because when we first moved out here, we had childcare 2 days a week, but they were, or 3 days a week, but they were on the days that I didn't really need our most childcare. So like our main shipping days, I was trying to manage two kids, one of which couldn't walk, but was only crawling, and a toddler who was in a new place who just was learning no and all that, you know, that crucial stage where they're just like really difficult and you can't take them anywhere. That was a stage we were when we moved out here, and it was really tough because I felt like I was trying, like as a mom, I feel like I try and balance this. Like I need like my business side to support my family, but also like the nurturing and caring for my kids. And some people, they can like separate those two things. But like for me, it was very, very hard because I wanted to do both things so well that like it, mentally and emotionally, it was wrecking me because I feel like I couldn't fulfill the things that I wanted to fulfill. And I felt like I was insufficient, which I was, because like, you can't do two full-time jobs well at the same time. Like, we're in a position now where like we're our youngest, like, you know, she naps during the times I need, or like the weather's been great so she can go outside with us. But like I try and have sitters on ship day so that way I can get more stuff done, because, you know, if she's sick or just getting into stuff, it is like it's really hard to get your attention on both things at the same time. One is much easier than two. Like one is much more manageable, but like on a busy, busy ship day, which like our club subscriptions happen once a month, I make sure that I have a sitter here because I can't do both. Like it's not fair to my kids. It's not fair to me. And emotionally, like, you know what you need. We were at a branding, and a good friend of mine, you know, she let her kids just wander around, and that's, you know, they're similar ages to mine. And she, like, I don't think she worried. Like, I think she could separate the two. Like, she knew her job with the branding and she was okay with the kids wandering. Whereas I couldn't do that. Like one of my kids was in daycare and the other kid was strapped to me. And I'm like, I can't put my kid down. Like, you know, what happens if a cow goes the wrong way, or like they get in a pinch point and the brakes go out of the truck? Like, I was just thinking of all the things that could go wrong in farming. And I personally couldn't separate those two apart, but I know a lot of people who can, and I commend them for that. But I think knowing it's okay to ask for help, and knowing that like you are not meant to do it all, because like you wouldn't expect your husband to do that. Like, so like, why do you think that you're expected to manage both? And my husband's good about saying like, oh, the kids will be fine, or like letting go a little bit. He doesn't have the emotional constraint as much as I do, but like he still worries about farming accidents because like they're very valid. Very valid concern. You know, a lot of kids have gotten hurt in farming accidents, and I don't know directly some, but I know indirectly of families who've gotten hurt. And I worked in the natural gas pipeline industry. So like early on to pay for my college. So like, I also know like around heavy equipment, there are pinch points and things where people have, you know, adults have gotten hurt. And I don't want my kids to ever be in that position of where like, they don't know what a pinch point is or like the tension that, a chain could have. So I'm very cautious of that, I think, based on my experience too.
That's all super valid. And we all know how unpredictable livestock can be. And, you know, there's so many different ways that our kids can get hurt. And it doesn't sound like, you know, spending a whole day in a freezer is going to be ideal for a baby either, right? I mean, sure, you could wrap them up. But yeah, if you have a full day's work to do, then also looking after a child at the same time turns that day into 2 days or maybe 3 days. So the efficiency of being able to have someone else who can love and care for your child while you do the job that you're good at, and they can look after your child, which they're probably going to be good at, is a total valid experience. And yeah, that perception that farm families don't need childcare or shouldn't need childcare is damaging for everybody. One thing that we talk a lot about on this show is about that transition point into motherhood. The going from zero to one, a lot of people talk about, you know, from one to two is also challenging for sure, but going from not being a parent to becoming a parent, what was that time in particular like for you?
It was tough because I think going back to that emotion, like I wanted to be the best mom possible, but I also wanted to be the best farmer possible, and not realizing like, I did all the chores. Like I cleaned out all of our brooders by myself. Like that was my job, is I cleaned out the poop out of the brooders. Well, like, you know, I can't touch my kid after I cleaned out brooders, even if she's crying. I don't really want to like, you know, nurse her right after, because I probably have poop or like debris or something in, you know, something in there that I can't really feed her. And like worrying that she'll get sick from like the, you know, the chicken poop, and how like, I, you know, you don't really realize like how harmful, I guess, things could be until you have kids. Cause then you're like more cautious of like, well, the brooder dust can hurt my kids. You know, like for me, I'm like, well, I just, you know, I didn't wear a mask, but it was fine. I was quick. You know, I had the fans going, but like your kids go out and you're like, oh man, that could cause something, you know, like you're a little bit more cautious. And I kind of realized like there are, you know, safety things that I may not have done before that I probably should have done. When my kids came into play, or like, you know, flies or mosquitoes, like if you don't want to put bug spray on your infant, like you got to figure out a solution because they're going to get bit, especially if they're out in the chicken tractor, like cows, trying to make sure you can watch them while you're also sorting livestock, because you don't want them to be like scared or scare the cow by screaming or run over or just, yeah, there are a lot of things I didn't realize until I became a parent. I think the biggest one would probably be like the emotional toll that it took between me. I was always worried about two things at the same time. And it's very hard to separate because like you're always going to have that worry about your kids. But like moderating it to the point where like you let things go. That happy medium.
Chris, so what's your favorite thing about raising kids on the farm? And what stain treatment tips do you have for us? This is going to be my new question for everyone, Arlene.
Having kids on the farm, it's really nice because I feel like it makes them be a little bit more independent, and it helps them. Like my goal is to show my kids the positive sides and the positives of like farming and ranching, and like the impact and the kind of the fruit of their labor. I want to show them the whole thing and not just like the chores. I don't want it to be something they despise, but something they actually enjoy too. And seeing how fun farming can be and how rewarding. And so far, it's like it's been like that for the kids. Like they have the freedom, but they also realize like we have to do chores even though it snows, or we have to, you know, and that's good because then the animal is healthy and it's happy, and you know, we eat and we're happy. So I feel like that part's good because I feel like it teaches them endurance and it teaches them long term goals. I feel like staying treatment wise, I started switching to like a more like natural products. And it works well in some ways, but you have to wash things in hot, like, warm water, which I had not done before. And Dawn is something I'm still continuing to use in my laundry, because Dawn is the only thing I feel like that takes out, like, the worst of the worst stains with my husband. Dawn works great.
It does feel like, as a farm parent, if you can't fix it with WD-40 duct tape or Dawn, just burn it. Just be done. Just, it's done for. Whatever. One thing we've talked about before, I know, is that part of my drive to start the podcast was being in a parenting group where people were saying, you know, they were debating cloth diapering, and there was this whole like, well, I can't cloth diaper because there'd be poop in my washing machine. And I was like, yeah, baby poop's probably one of the less gross things that has been in my washing machine. Like, it washes it. I mean, it's like, it's getting clean. That's the whole point, you know, hopefully.
Yeah, the one my husband spilled Cydectin, which is like a dewormer, and it's like a purple stain all in our truck, and it got over on my daughter's jacket. And in case you're wondering, rubbing alcohol takes off permanent marker and Cydectin. I've used it both to get things out. So if you need add rubbing alcohol to your list of of cleaners, because it Cydectin was probably the worst thing I had spilled all over, or in our washer.
That's good to know, though, because I've blue coated my hands before, and I bet it's the same. I'll have to try that next time.
Yep.
Because that
rubbing alcohol,
that blue coat wound spray does not come out. Takes a while.
Yeah. Soak. You have to soak it. But rubbing alcohol, like, I buy it from Costco in bulk, and rubbing alcohol works really well. Like, I soaked it in the sink in rubbing alcohol a few times, rinsed it and repeat, and then add the Dawn, and it took it out.
Those are some hot tips for sure. What is your biggest parenting struggle these days? And it doesn't have to be farm related.
I think probably torn between, like, I feel kind of going like what she was saying, how some people like homeschool their kids because they're home. Like, part of me would love to do more of like the homeschooling, like fun activities with my kids, even on the weekends. And I like, I'm always torn between like, I need to do this project for our business, or so like probably torn between like still managing stuff for our business and keeping it fun for our kids, plus also the expectations of society of like not homeschooling my children, you know, I don't know, not planning out random activities for a whole day and an obstacle course in our house. And I'm like, my brain does not work that way. Like, we do fun things, but it's not, I'm not building an obstacle course in my living room and then taping off like tech mats on the floor and all those things. So I think still knowing I can be a good parent, I feel like, and not letting my kid down, so not those things, if that makes any sense.
The internal expectation that we put on ourselves sometimes comes from what we see other parents doing, but it doesn't have to be. We don't have to all be that kind of parent, for sure.
Carissa, too, as someone who's a couple years ahead of you, it's been really cool to start working some, like, experiential learning into things, you know, of, like, having my daughter help keep the sheep records, or asking my son how many chicks are in a picture. And I'm like, look at me, home educating my kids, making sure they're getting practice. Totally not just trying to distract them so I can get my shit done while they keep asking about the Xbox. Like, you know, your kids are going to learn stuff, whether you set up like magazine perfect things for them or not. And
yeah, whether you take a picture of it or not, they're still going to learn some stuff.
And whether you can post it or not, because your kitchen's a mess and even you are embarrassed not saying anything.
And I think like that's the other part too, is like we recently went through my daughter where she like did not like her hair fixed long. And like now she'll let me put like pigtails or something in. But before, I guess I didn't realize it because I was naive yet. But like some other parents, like at daycare, judged me because my kid's hair wasn't fixed. I would brush it, but she wouldn't let me like fix it. I didn't realize that they were judging me because my kid's hair wasn't in pigtails. And it was like, by the end of the day, it was like, you know, everywhere. And I did not realize I was being judged for that. So like, I would sometimes not post my kid's picture, but I wouldn't think that other parents would judge me. So I'm like, oh, their kid's probably going through this too. No. So like, we've worked on that, like making her hair a little bit more presentable, but still like my kid's usually like either naked or covered in chocolate or poof or something where it's hard to like photograph and make it pretty. Which is what people want to see.
See, I'm just leading by example and making space for these people to post horrifying pictures of their kids because, yeah, same. And I try to remind myself that anybody who's got a problem with it is welcome to either try to do my kid's hair or be quiet about it.
Yeah. Or just not follow you and not engage.
Yeah. You're welcome to not know about it. All right. So we ask all of our guests, if you were going to dominate a category at the county fair, what would it be? And categories can be real or made up to ensure that you win.
I would say it would be the category of just like learning something new. Like, I know that sounds silly, but I feel like my entire life, whether it's parenting, like cooking. I didn't really like, my parents weren't always like the most present parents. I didn't get a whole lot from them except for like working. And I feel like having to learn how to cook by myself from not having that education, learning how to like parent and be present with my kids in some ways, like learning how to work cattle, learning how to fix things. I feel like that's one thing I feel like I've been good at. Like, you don't have to be raised to learn to know how to do something. You just have to be willing to put in the work and learn it. And I've done that with several aspects of my life. So I think I would dominate that category of like, just learning how to learn something, be willing to learn.
I think that's a fantastic answer.
Yeah. Just from our conversation today, I can tell that you have learned a lot of things in your life already. So I'm not going to challenge you on that category. So we will go ahead and move into our cussing and discussing segment. Our listeners can send in their own either on our SpeakPipe or by email. You can check the show notes for the links to those. Katie, what are you cussing and or discussing this week?
I'm changing my answer, Arlene, but as you and your sister.
Well, no one knows what it was anyway, so whatever you want.
Well, good. Then you won't know that I changed it. I believe I sent a picture to you and your sisters last night, Arlene. I didn't publish it because my kitchen's a mess. I exploded a container of sheep electrolytes that I was mixing in my face, in my kitchen. And as I went on through the night, I'm realizing there's still some in my hair. There's sheep electrolytes on my kitchen ceiling, and everything from my kitchen sink to about halfway across the dining room has very, very sticky, bright orange electrolytes on it. And it was in a shaker bottle. I don't know how it exploded.
Maybe rubbing alcohol will fix that.
So I am cussing and discussing things that are sticky and realizing as an adult that you still have no idea how to clean a specific item, because our kitchen ceiling is textured flat paint and it now has...
Oh, that's just going to live there. Now you just have to spackle it with electrolytes. Create a pattern.
I'm trying to figure out how to text the painter who's coming to do the exterior and ask if, because we had already talked about having the kitchen ceiling redone, asking if I have to clean it off before they can paint it, or if we can just like, I don't know, prime over it,
cover that up.
Yeah, because it's on the ceiling fan, it's everywhere, and I don't know why it exploded. But obviously it did. So word of warning, folks, be careful with the sheep electrolytes. It did keep the sheep alive, so it was worth it, but...
Okay, so you salvaged enough, or did you shake up another bottle?
Oh, no, I salvaged the rest. Thankfully, I had made extra. Chris, what do you have to cuss and discuss today?
Well, this weather. So it caused our road to... kind of shut down, so that way my main driver doesn't come to our house now for boxes today. So the weather sucks, it's icy, and it's caused some inconvenience in my life today.
That's just gonna add to your week, isn't it?
Arlene, what do you have to cuss and discuss?
So mine is it's spring, which is great, and the snow has disappeared, which is also great, but that means that the garbage that all the people throw out of their cars and think just disappears is now very visible, and a lot of it ends up in our fields. And so last night, my husband and I were at the stage where our kids are old enough that we can go for a walk and just leave them in the house. So that's a whole new thing that we're doing, and the days are longer. So we went out for a walk last night and surveyed all of the garbage that we're going to have to clean up, because you can't grow crops in fields that have cans and bottles and lots of Tim Hortons cups and all that gross stuff in it. So the other thing about older kids, we can also send them out there to help us clean it up. But it's just so gross. I don't understand why people can't just keep the garbage in their vehicles and then put it in a garbage bag somewhere when they arrive somewhere, instead of tossing it out the window and letting us deal with it. So gross. Don't litter.
Can you, does any of your like 4-H groups or side groups, would they be willing to like come help? Is like a community service project?
Yeah, probably. The one road that's the worst is not that long. And I think that we're just going to use the workforce that we've got.
And say, Arlene, do you want me to send a boy child up? Because he's pretty obsessive about cleaning up the fields.
Yeah, he likes to clean up garbage too.
I took him out once this fall to pick up one piece of plastic, and we were most of the way across the field by the time he was finished.
We will get it cleaned up for sure, but it's just, yeah, it's nasty. Even just this morning, I took the dog for a walk and I filled up a whole plastic bag of just empties. So clearly there are a lot of people drinking and driving too that are just tossing their cans out the window because there's way more of those than I want to see in my ditch too, which is kind of scary.
And I mean, it's just gross because like the roadkill surfaces in the spring too, but they didn't really have a, you know, they didn't do it on purpose. Where humans throwing stuff out is like, yeah.
So thank you so much, Carissa, for joining us today. If people want to follow you online, where should they find you if they want to order some meat from Kansas?
CoveyRaisBeef.com or just CoveyRaisBeef on Instagram or Facebook.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Follow along our hot mess.
Yes, for sure. We love a hot mess.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on, Carissa.
Thank you for joining us on Barnyard Language. If you enjoy the show, please support us on Patreon with a donation.
Big thanks go out to our show editor, Krista Paffrath, at the Rural Podcast Network.
Please rate and review the podcast wherever you listen and follow the show so you never miss an episode.
If you want to connect with other farming families, join the private Barnyard Language Facebook group.
We are always in search of future guests for the podcast. If you or someone you know would like to chat with us, get in touch.